Hey everyone, welcome back to Strange New Worlds, a science and Star Trek podcast. I'm your host, Mike Wong. One of my favorite topics to think about is the origin of life. It's such a profound question, and an indispensable part of the story of who we are. Every single living thing on planet Earth descended from a common ancestor. But how that ancestor came to be is shrouded in mystery. Scientists sometimes imagine plausible scenarios for the origin of life, and so too do science fiction writers. In the Star Trek The Next Generation series finale, All Good Things, the omnipotent being named Q takes Captain Picard back through time to witness the origin of life on Earth. How does that scene compare to what origin of life scientists think might have happened roughly 4 billion years ago in what is known as Earth's Hadean Eon? Here to answer that question and more is Professor Paul Rimmer, whom I met up with while I was visiting the University of Cambridge earlier this month. Ready? Engage. Hi, everyone. Hello from Trinity College at the University of Cambridge, where I have just finished a faculty interview to potentially be a professor here. And it is a wonderful thing to be done with that interview. I feel so relieved. And to flip it around and actually be an interviewer of somebody. So sitting across from me is Professor Paul Rimmer, who's a professor here of physics. That's mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
And you study all manners of astrobiological questions, ranging from the origin of life to biosignatures. And these are the types of questions that we love talking about on Strange New Worlds and blending them with Star Trek because, hey, Star Trek's all about seeking out new life and trying to understand these deep questions about the universe. And, you know, being at Cambridge and knowing that you are an expert in the origin of life, the natural Star Trek episode to talk about is All Good Things, the finale from TNG.
One of my favorite episodes.
Yeah, it's such a good one, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful episode.
So the connection to Cambridge is that in this episode, we are introduced to a future timeline where we see all of our TNG characters have aged into new roles. One of those new roles is Data's role as a professor at Cambridge.
Yes. He's the Lucasian professor, which was the chaired professorship that Isaac Newton also held, and Stephen Hawking as well.
So many famous names here at Cambridge, from antiquity all the way to the future with Professor Data.
Yeah, exactly.
And in between Newton, Hawking, and Data is you.
I am not one of the Lucasian professors, so but yeah, there's actually a long history of astrobiology and origins of life here as well in a couple of respects. Darwin was here, and Darwin proposed first the warm little pond. And Tom Gold was here, and he ended up going to Cornell and was very instrumental in getting Carl Sagan hired there, and also had his own origin of life theory, which, like many origin of life theories, both in the past and today, is controversial and speculative, but also a lot of fun to dig into.
Was Gold's the hot, deep biosphere hypothesis?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is different from what a lot of origin of life research is today, in terms of more shallow, superficial ponds mm-hmm. that are exposed to the air, which we will talk about.
I think Gold was right about two really important things that even factor into surface scenarios in many cases. There is actually a very active deep biosphere. Most of the life is beneath our feet. Also, I do think that there's a great potential for a lot of different chemistry beneath our feet. And I don't think all of it is biotic as well. So, but that's something that we can dig into later.
Yeah, sounds good. So, Paul, tell me about your first contact with Star Trek.
So, it's almost like asking what my first kind of memory of my parents is in a certain respect, because my parents were really, really big Star Trek fans, both original series and then in Next Generation. And I was quite young. Original series certainly predates me, and I was quite young when Next Generation came out. And so all those sort of memories kind of get mixed up. The first thing that I remember seeing was Data opening up his chest and pulling out a phone, or something like this happening. Sort of psychological episode. I think it involved Data's dreams. That terrified me as a child. But the first thing that I really remember, the first place where I became really, really interested with Star Trek was with an overlap with one of my favorite science fiction writers, is Isaac Asimov. I used to read a lot of his science fiction, and the Measure of a Man episode was the one that I really remember solidly first. And the connection between that and some of Asimov's speculations about what it means to be human really, really resonated with me and got me very interested in the whole series.
That's the one where Data goes on trial to see if he has human rights, right?
Correct, yeah. Yes.
Okay, yeah, it's a brilliant episode. And it's so striking to me that your first memory of Star Trek was Data, because that's also my first memory. Not the phone episode, but the one called Masks, where Data is inhabited by all these different ancient personalities. I found that Brent Spiner's acting was just so enthralling that I wanted to learn more about what I was watching, even though I had no concept of what Star Trek was at such an early age. I'm curious to know, from your perspective, since you were terrified, what actually brought you back, and what did you end up appreciating about Star Trek once you got over that fear of Data's dreams?
So the first part of Star Trek that I really enjoyed was actually the fourth motion picture.
Oh, yeah.
The second one, my parents kind of watched them in sequence, and there were aspects of the second and the fourth that really, really resonated with me. But Spock, as a character, who happened to be a scientist,
yes,
I really found him very appealing. I liked his sort of logic. I liked his the way that he was able to control his emotions. I think that for us humans, that's not so healthy. But at that time, I just found it so fascinating, just that kind of perspective of being alien. And he was interested in science, and so my father was a scientist, a geophysicist, and so I thought that there was something kind of interesting there to explore further in the Star Trek universe, because I thought, well, you know, Spock and my dad have something in common in terms of trying to explore things about the universe. And I started to get interested in what aspects of that exploration of the universe there really were. And so original series, I found it difficult to get into a little bit, but I was very interested in Spock. I kind of gave the rest of Star Trek a little bit more of a chance, watched a few other episodes. Actually, now I really enjoy that episode about Data's dreams. Mm-hmm. I think that that's a great episode, but I started to watch those a little bit more. I found that there was a lot in common between Spock and Data, at least superficially. And so I kind of moved to being really interested in Data and just, you know, what was going on in his head. And I was reading lots of Asimov and things about robots as well at that particular time. And it really was Measure of a Man that got me hooked in the whole Star Trek universe. Before then, it was just kind of a curiosity kind of thing.
Awesome. Wow. Yeah. Wow. Would you say that Star Trek impacted what you ended up pursuing in terms of your academics and then eventually becoming a scientist yourself?
It certainly got me interested in the questions of cosmology, which is where I first got into science.
Oh, fascinating.
I was always interested in origins, and it seemed like the origin of the universe was the really big question.
Absolutely.
And there are all kinds of aspects of that that appear throughout in Star Trek.
So how did you get into the origin of life field then?
Well, I did start out being very interested in the theoretical cosmology, really trying to figure out origin of the universe stuff. I started in string theory, and I realized that I wasn't as good at math as I imagined I was, and that people in my same class who were much better at math than I was were having trouble staying in science. A lot of them became actuaries, or they went onto the stock market, and I'm sure that a lot of that was very interesting, but I really wanted to stay in science. And it turned out that there was this chemist who was looking for a physics student who had a high-energy physics background, who could calculate some cross-sections for cosmic rays hitting molecules in the interstellar medium. And that was my crossover into actually thinking about origins of stars. Mm-hmm. And I just kept getting smaller, colder from there.
Yeah. So as an expert in the origin of life, I feel like you're the perfect person to talk to about one particular scene in All Good Things, the scene where Q takes Jean-Luc Picard all the way back in time to the early Earth, and they witness, or actually don't witness, the origin of life because Q's anti-time anomaly screws things up. So let me just paint the picture of this scene. When they visit the early Earth, Q and Picard are just kind of standing on this very black cliff next to a pond of goo, and you can see sort of like volcanic eruptions happening in the background. Q says it's a very dirty, messy place. There's too much sulfur in the air. If you touch the wall, you get, you know, little black smudges on your fingers. And then they bend over and they see this organic goo. We'll talk about the origin of life itself in just a second, but my first question to you is that depiction of the early Earth accurate? Is that what we actually think the early Earth looks like?
My answer to that is that we don't have a clear enough picture of what the early Earth was like to say whether that is entirely accurate or not. The sort of clues that we have about early Earth is that aspects of that would be correct, like volcanism was more active and probably hotter, at least in a lot of regions. There was at least some dry land. Volcanic islands, for example, would be that sort of dry land. And so if you were near a pond, at least given certain scenarios that tried to predict how much dry land there was, it'd be more likely you'd be on a volcanic island and then you'd see volcanoes. So that part makes sense. It might have been quite a bit colder at that time, actually. There are some studies that suggest that because of the greater impact rates, there would have been more exposed silicates, which would have removed more CO2. And also the sun was smaller. And the combination of those, absent any other surprising greenhouse gases, would have suggested that things were a little bit colder. But really, I mean, I like the phrase of the Hadean, not because of it meaning like a hellscape, which a lot of people imagine, but Hades is this dark place after death that we just don't know a lot about. And this is a sort of dark place before life that we just don't know a lot about.
Fascinating.
And so it's more about the sort of passage into ignorance. There's just a lot that we don't know and a lot that we won't really be able to constrain, at least on Earth, given its geological activity that kind of erases a lot of this history. There's no known way to really figure out what the Hadean was like on Earth.
So interesting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's like before, like past the veil in terms of our ability to really pin it down as an environment. But I like what you said about it might have been colder back then. Mm-hmm. So Picard probably should have brought a jacket.
Yeah, exactly.
The fact that they're just standing there breathing, what do you make of that?
Oh, that's his cue. That aspect of it, I mean, if that wasn't just Q, Q would be fine, I suppose, regardless of where he is, but Picard would suffocate because one of the few things that we do know well about the early Earth is that there was not very much oxygen. The amount of oxygen was below probably around one part per million in the atmosphere. And the reason that we know about that, there are a variety of different ways that we can tell, but one of the most striking ways is we can look for rust. And when you start looking further and further back, you get these sort of patterns where a lot of the rock is rusted, and then you get these places where a portion is rusted, and then a portion isn't, and a portion is rusted, and a portion isn't. And when you get far enough back, it's not rusted at all.
Yeah. I love those rocks, by the way, the banded iron formations.
Exactly.
I've got one sitting on my table at home. It's just lovely to look
wonderful.
At. Yeah. Yep. Okay, so that's great. So that's the environment. It's somewhat accurate, maybe a few tweaks here and there that you would improve. Let's talk now about when they lean over this puddle of goo. Mm. And Q mentions that, oh, there go the little amino acids. they're about to link up to form what you would call life. But then they don't. But assuming that they did, you know, then that would have been the origin of life. Is that the picture that you have in your mind with regard to what actually happened at the origin of life?
Not precisely. I would say that my picture of what I think actually happened, just like the picture of the Hadean, is more shrouded in ignorance than that. And first of all, life is more than just linking up a handful of amino acids. That probably could have happened in many different settings. It probably actually absent some very interesting chemistry that really could have been there, especially near a volcano. It probably wouldn't have happened while it was wet. This is actually one of the wonderful things about the way that life as we know it is set up. This might be general to life, especially in a water solvent. I don't think this would be true in other solvents, maybe, but life in a water solvent, I think, would likely have this sort of property, which is that you have all these sort of Lego pieces for life. You have the nucleotides, which make up the DNA and the RNA, the informational polymers. You have the amino acids, which make up the proteins, which control the chemistry, really important to make sure some reactions happen faster than others, to keep us from going back into equilibrium. And there are these phospholipids, which create a container to help to contain and control this sort of chemistry. And there's a metabolism, which are a series of reactions that help to either take complex molecules and take the energy out of them by breaking them apart, or take energy and build these complex molecules out of that energy. And all of these sorts of things eventually kind of have to emerge in this sort of environment. But all of these pieces, as it turns out, when they link together, you don't want them as Lego pieces to just link together whenever they meet, because then you just end up with a mess. Mm. You actually want them to not react, except when you want them to react.
Huh.
And the way that life does this is it uses a lot of different things, but one of the main things that it uses is a control of water activity.
Mm-hmm.
It makes these particular molecules, when they link together, release water. And since life is in water, these reactions are enormously thermodynamically disfavored.
Mm.
And a big thing enzymes do is actually surround those parts of the molecules and get rid of the water,
yeah,
so that the molecules can link, which is really cool. So then you can have the reactions when you want and not when you don't. What this means, though, is before you have all these enzymes and everything, you want these reactions to occur, you have to get rid of the water. So wet-dry cycles, freeze-thaw cycles, these sorts of things are a go-to for a lot of prebiotic chemistry. So maybe if they were at the very, very edge where things were drying out,
mm-hmm,
that's where you might see these sort of things linked together. That being said, there's a natural condensation reactions in chemistry, reactions that will remove the water naturally in water. But they just do it by parts. Instead of removing it as H2O, they remove it as an OH here and an H there. So it could still happen that way. It just seems like, given what we know, maybe a more likely thing would be, especially if you're already invoking that you're doing this in a warm little pond, one of the best things about the pond is that you have access to these dry areas or these frozen areas where you can do the sort of wet, dry, or freeze-thaw chemistry, where you can get rid of the water naturally. And then there are many experiments that would do exactly this. They would link all the amino acids together. I don't know what a spatial anomaly would do that would stop thermodynamics from working that way, that wouldn't be disastrous in some larger sense. But that part, I think, is quite likely. If you have the amino acids, there's going to be lots of environments where you make chains of them. That's not life, though. That's just building polypeptides.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so to summarize, if you could influence the set design and writing of this episode, you would have put maybe some ice on the ground because mm-hmm, it was colder,
yeah,
and you would have had this origin of life occur maybe at the edges of a pond or in a pond that had just dried up,
mm-hmm,
so that you can have those condensation reactions. Counterintuitively, yep, life to begin, you need to get rid of the water, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would have had Q say something a little bit more elaborate than just amino acids linking up. Because as you said, that's one part of life, but not all of it.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that if the anomaly was really stopping these condensation reactions from happening, and that if this was the environment where they had to happen to go to the next step, that certainly would end the story there. So maybe this was just a very early on part of it that got disrupted by this strange phenomena.
That's a good point.
I think there'd still be a way to go about that. But if I were to rewrite it, I would probably have something a little bit more complex about talking about, you can see the sort of vesicles coming out, these protocells.
Yeah.
They're containing some of these molecules. There's a ribozyme, which is being catalyzed by these sorts of proteins. And oh my goodness, the ribozyme is not making copies of itself
mm-hmm.
with high enough accuracy. Evolution is impossible now.
Mm.
And that's too bad. No life as we know it anyway.
I like the idea of this anti-time anomaly disrupting the origin of life. From my recollection of this episode, this anomaly is traveling backwards in time, or it's expanding backwards in time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the origin of life, the way we think about it, is a story of complexification over time. So if something is reversing time somehow, maybe you cannot build up that complexity.
Maybe so.
But that's probably in the realm of sci-fi.
Yeah. No, it's a cool idea anyway. And one of the things that I like about it that is really relevant to right now origins research is the question of contingency versus necessity. If it turned out that you had to have just the right conditions that just happened to come together in the right way in order for life to emerge, that could have been disrupted by some random thing.
Yeah.
And since this is a nonlinear process, it may not even be obvious what that random thing was that disrupted this and then made it so that it just didn't work. Whereas there are ideas that life is more like a sort of phase change of matter. And so once you get the right sort of conditions where you can build up this kind of disequilibrium in an open system, life will just pop out. That's just like ice comes from water.
Yeah.
Life comes from environments that get into the right part of the phase space.
Yeah.
And I suppose that these would overlap if that region of life in the phase space is very small. Then these at least would, in terms of the predictions, be the same. But I think in terms of what's really going on, and certainly on a philosophical level, those are two very different pictures of how life would have emerged.
Right. And I guess the picture that Q is portraying, you know, if we take Star Trek as literal for one second, is that it's in the camp of chance because a tiny fluctuation, the space-time anomaly, disrupted all of life. And because it disrupted it at that moment, life on Earth would never be. But if you were in the other camp or universe where life is one of these more necessary sort of phase change processes, okay, you messed it up now, but, you know, wait five more minutes. It might come back or something like that. It's kind of an inevitable process.
Yep.
And so the picture that Star Trek is positing is actually one view and not another.
Yes. And in fact, there's a third view, which is something more like design. And in fact, this is where there's an inconsistency, a potential or at least apparent inconsistency in Star Trek, where there was an episode a while before, I don't remember the name, maybe you do, where Picard ends up finding this, or Picard's archaeology teacher ends up finding this particular artifact. He ends up getting killed by Romulans, I think. There's this whole puzzle that's written into people's DNA.
Yeah.
And it turns out that, you know, maybe not the very first life, but the most of the life in the Star Trek universe, life that Star Trek knows about, was designed. In fact, it was both designed and seeded by this other progenitor alien race. And it's all related in this sort of way. And you could imagine unifying these by saying that maybe this anomaly messed up the sort of experiment that the aliens left over. But this gives you the sort of three options, all three, which were very, very early on in the research in origins of life, which is chance, necessity, and design. And the design one, Crick, Francis Crick, was very big on this sort of directed panspermia idea. But I would say most origins researchers discount that, mostly because the evidence isn't there. We don't find trademarks in our DNA so far. But the sort of chance and necessity part remains a very, very interesting conversation. I'm not sure if it's so much one or the other. And I'm also not sure if there isn't some sort of fourth option out there.
Interesting.
Because I don't think that you can show that these are logically all either mutually exclusive or all-encompassing.
Right.
It does seem as though chemistry tends to be directed toward certain outcomes, much like physics is directed towards certain outcomes, like taking the shortest path between two points, finding the sort of lowest energy state, various other things like this, that I would say aren't completely captured by necessity, because that's not always what happens, and also not by chance, because it's not just like a random roll of the dice.
Yeah.
There's this ordering, there's this structure, and there's a sort of end goal actually involved in that. But that's also not design either. And so I do think that there's something, and there are hints in physics, there are hints in chemistry, and there are definitely hints in biology, that there's something else involved that's not any of those three. Natural selection itself is certainly not any of those three.
So is natural selection the fourth option, or is there something in addition that is missing?
I think there has to be a pre-natural selection kind of evolution. Mm-hmm. Natural selection has certain requirements. There was a very important chemist, Manfred Eigen. He was a student of Heisenberg. So the connection between physics and chemistry in Origins is long-storied. Manfred Eigen was really interested in chemical kinetics. He was also interested in, later on in his career, in origins of life. And he was really interested in the origin of information. He was very, very much involved with the information. And he was very interested in the sort of copying of information. And he came up with a really almost sort of fundamental, almost kind of like law of physics about origins, which is that if you want Darwinian evolution, specifically Darwinian evolution, then you have to copy information very accurately, but not perfectly accurately. If it's perfectly accurately, you don't have the mutations, so you can't have evolution by natural selection. At the same time, if the accuracy is too low, then your children don't look enough like you.
Mm.
And so then there's nothing to select.
Yeah.
And he was able to break this down to a mathematical rule, which is that your copying accuracy has to be proportional to the inverse of the amount of information that you're trying to copy. So okay. If you're copying 100 monomers, you tend to have around 1% accuracy. There's a little bit of wiggle room around that. There are some clever caveats around that. But for the most part, that's what that is. And in fact, that's what life does, is almost all life hugs this particular boundary. It's as chaotic as it can be while still being orderly enough to preserve that possibility for Darwinian evolution.
There's this phrase that is often bandied about, the edge of chaos is in the emergence literature. And I feel like what you're saying is exactly this. Yeah, mm-hmm. you're as disordered as you can be without spilling over into absolute disorder.
Yep.
But you need that disorder. Disorder is good sometimes so that you can evolve and change.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that's a limit for natural selection. So whatever the other option is for origins, it can't be natural selection, at least not understood in that specific way. But there may still be other sorts of selection. Eigen distinguishes this very, very abruptly as natural selection selects for function. And selection before natural selection just selects for structure. That's the only thing it can select for. And one of the things you might hope is that structure and function overlap mm-hmm. fortuitously. I think that there may be other things that get selected for that cannot be so easily defined by what we would understand as function or structure. And that might be the sort of middle regime that might be very fruitful to explore, and that I know that you've done some thinking in exploring as well.
We should think together about these things, because it's yeah. clearly an open question, but so important to try to answer if you want to know about the origin of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, hope I can come to Cambridge and keep working with you.
That would be great.
I wanted to touch upon two more things. The first is, we last saw each other in person in Quito, Ecuador, at an mm-hmm. Origins of Life conference. You gave a really enthralling talk there. I think this brand new framework of origin of life as, was it braided streams or something like that?
Yes.
Okay. Could you explain for our audience what you mean by the origin of life as these kinds of streams?
Sure. So that would be another way in which Q's picture could have been changed, is maybe it wasn't a pond. And that is another thing that is worth saying, is a pond is, it's like a single environment, at least on the surface. And so you might say, well, I don't like this, because life is dynamic, and probably origins of life is dynamic too. And a pond seems very stagnant. Mm-hmm. I think that this involves a limited imagination about how dynamic ponds really are. I think ponds actually have a lot of potential for really interesting dynamic kinds of chemistry. But it's easier to picture in streams, because streams have flow. Flow really helps with a lot of this chemistry. And streams allow you to segregate certain aspects of chemistry, both in space and time. A lot of this particular thinking about streams arose through some of John Sutherland's chemistry. John Sutherland's chemistry was really looking at how you build nucleotides. And nucleotides have three parts. They have a phosphate group, a sugar, and a base. And when you think about that, and you look at how life puts it together, it takes the phosphate group, the sugar, and the base, clicks them together. Those are dehydration reactions again, mm-hmm. so they get rid of the water. If you try to do this with regular dehydration, you just end up with a mess. This doesn't work. You need some kind of condensation reaction. Leslie Orgel, a brilliant prebiotic chemist, looked into this, didn't find anything that worked very well, found reactions that would get you your desired product, but only in yields of a few percent, which is just a disaster for effective prebiotic chemistry. And so kind of set that aside. John Sutherland's real breakthrough was realizing that although life put things together this way, you can actually build these structures as making a sort of part sugar, part base. And then you can kind of put the extra part of the base on top of that. Mm. And you don't need the same kind of dehydration reactions. You still, as far as we know, still need one for adding the phosphate in the end. That still requires dehydration. So they still need something like wet-dry cycles, even in that sort of picture. But you don't need it for building the nucleoside, okay, which is the base plus the sugar. No phosphate. That part you can do. It turns out phosphate itself is still really important for controlling that chemistry, but you don't need to add the phosphate on there. And you can do that all in solution, and you can do that in a way that gets very high yield, so you get a lot of the product that you want, and that's a good thing for at least those early stages of the prebiotic chemistry. Well, doing this involves two branches off of two different sugars called glycolaldehyde and glyceraldehyde. The really important thing is one has two carbons and one has three carbons. And the really important thing is that if you try the chemistry with both of these together, you end up with an absolute mess. Hmm. You have to segregate the chemistry so that one part of this happens in one place, the other part happens in the other. Ah. And when these get far enough, then you can mix them and it's fine. In fact, then you have to mix them so you can get the next stage. Mm-hmm. So if somehow you had two streams, one that did your glyceraldehyde chemistry and one that just got to glycolaldehyde and then branched off, mm-hmm, then you get to certain other parts, and these other parts end up coming together to form what it is that you need. Now, there are other branches of this chemistry. It turns out that there are other ways the chemistry can, quote, fail. But when they branch off, they end up forming amino acids, phospholipids. This is one of the reasons why this is such a promising potential kind of scenario from a synthetic chemistry perspective, is you get all of these different ingredients by the way that you branch off. But the important thing is a lot of these branches are inconsistent with each other. And so this introduces a contingency. If this really is the way that you have to originate life, and you really need this series of streams, it turns out you don't need very many streams before you really start running into trouble. And the fact that we can already identify three, maybe four streams, and we haven't really even linked these molecules together, much less gotten to something that really starts looking like life, mm-hmm, how many more streams would we need?
Interesting.
And if you need enough extra streams, then life becomes very rare.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that I was talking about.
So to summarize, in order to finally get to life, you need to mix a bunch of different building blocks together, but you can't mix them too soon or else they interfere with each other and you just create a mess.
Yep.
You need to evolve, select, generate certain products somewhere, a certain other set of products somewhere else. And this is why your picture of streams literally intersecting, bringing one type of molecule and another type of molecule together at some stage later than some prescribed. I think I get the picture. It's very intriguing, and maybe I would really love to see this depicted in Star Trek. You know,
it would be a fun thing to see these sorts of streams coming down. I guess the sort of question is, you know, maybe Q didn't even need his anomaly. He could have just diverted one stream. This does generate a lot of contingency. One of the neat things is that contingency is actually, I think, a really good feature, mm-hmm, of the model rather than a flaw. For the same reason that Joseph Moran does some really, really interesting chemistry. Sometimes he uses some really weird metals. Mm-hmm. And some people see this as a flaw. I see this as a feature. This is saying, if you're really going to do this, then there's only a fraction of the environment that you can do this in. All of a sudden, we can start making predictions about how common or rare life should be on the basis of this. These aren't very robust predictions, but they can start to inch toward, you know, if we find life, mm-hmm, absolutely everywhere, that's going to say something about how contingent this kind of chemistry could be. It can't be more contingent than a certain amount. If it has to be the streams, then it can't be more than, say, a certain number of streams, or else we wouldn't have expected to find life this close to us. If we do, then that just suggests, as correct as that chemistry might be, mm-hmm, there must be an easier way to do it. There must be a less contingent way to bring this about.
That perfectly slides into my last question, which is about the expectations for life elsewhere in the universe. And I love how you've framed it as our search for life in the universe is actually going to teach us something about the origins of life, because I really do see those questions as two sides of the same coin. They're going to inform one another.
Me too.
I've long been a fan of your work. One of my favorite papers of yours is the abiogenesis zone, which sort of complements this idea of the habitable zone, right? Where the habitable zone is defined as the region around a star where you can have stable liquid water on the surface of an Earth-like planet, therefore maintaining life. But it says nothing about starting life from scratch, and you invented this abiogenesis zone, and it has really profound implications for where we should expect life to be in the universe. So could you walk us through what the abiogenesis zone is and what the conclusions of your study were?
So I've already described some of John Sutherland's chemistry. So earlier on, to get that glycolaldehyde and glyceraldehyde, a good way to do that is the only known way to do that through this sort of scenario is with hydrogen cyanide, some sort of anion, some negatively charged ion, and ultraviolet light. The ultraviolet light shines on the negatively charged ion that detaches one of those electrons, and that electron can go and attach itself onto the cyanide, and it reduces it. It changes the cyanide to a particular group that still has the nitrogen and a hydrogen attached to it. It gets extra hydrogens attached to that carbon. And then that particular group, that NH group, rapidly hydrolyzes. What that means is that the NH leaves with water, and it takes the extra two hydrogens off of the water to make ammonia, and that remaining oxygen becomes an aldehyde, a doubly bonded oxygen. That's really, really important, because that's part of what it is to be a sugar, is that you have those sorts of things. And that's why it's called glycolaldehyde. There are ways to build up glycolaldehyde off of that. Actually, the first one you make is formaldehyde, and then there's an extra step to make the glycolaldehyde and then the glyceraldehyde. All of this involves ultraviolet light, and there's degradation chemistry. The stuff can fall apart too. So if you weigh up how much light you need so that the chemistry that gets you the sugars wins out over the degradation chemistry, then that's the amount of light that you need for the scenario to play out successfully. And it turns out, then you can look at the thing you know best about any exoplanet system, which is the star.
Yeah.
And then you can start to make some conclusions about where this sort of chemistry could occur. This does not tell you where life is. This just tells you where this chemistry could occur. We don't know whether this chemistry can lead to life, because origins of life is an unsolved problem. We don't know if any of these scenarios actually works. But what we do know is that if the scenario did work out, and in fact, if this was the dominant scenario, this would tell you something about where you would expect to find life. You would find life around those sorts of planets, around those sorts of stars that produce the right amount of ultraviolet light. And that turns out to be stars like our sun, actually. Stars like these ultra-cool stars, where we actually find most of these potentially habitable planets. Mm-hmm. We still don't actually know if they're actually habitable, but potentially habitable planets. Are at least in their quiet emission, their kind of average UV emission, they don't produce enough ultraviolet light to do this chemistry effectively. Maybe when they flare, this is an experiment I'm involved with right now. I have a graduate student working on this right now and finding some interesting results. Maybe the flares can do it. Mm-hmm. But without the flares, it can't be done. And in fact, even with the flares, probably with many of these stars, the less active ones, even when they were young, they couldn't have done this kind of chemistry. That's a great thing, because, in fact, maybe a little counterintuitively, that's where I'd want to look for life first.
Absolutely. Because you've basically framed the origin of life as a testable hypothesis that nature's done the experiment. We just have to go and find the data. We have to go interrogate nature and figure
it out. Yeah. If you keep finding life and the distribution of that life, because it's really going to be, I think, about statistics. I don't think we'll ever know for sure, barring certain extraordinary sets of biosignatures. I don't think we'll ever really know for sure whether any exoplanet really has life on it. What we'll know is we'll have a sort of Bayesian probability. We'll say 80% chance. But if you get enough planets where you have an 80% chance, then you have a very high chance that it's at least on some of them. Mm-hmm. And if they all have a distribution where they happen to be around active M dwarfs that are active enough to do this chemistry, it doesn't tell you it has to be this chemistry, but it's evidence for it. Whereas if the distribution doesn't match that, and especially if you can find good examples, several good examples where it's a bad match for it, where it was around quiet M dwarfs, then that actually suggests that
although this chemistry might still be important, it's not the dominant way for life to start. There must be some other way, at least that life started there, and we should start looking into that. So you can actually start to test some of these hypotheses this way. And not just with ultraviolet light, that's just the easiest one because that's the light of the star, but you can start doing this with impact rates. If you need dry land, you can start doing this with the amount of water on planets, so you can start looking at their densities. All sorts of different dimensions can start to be explored from that standpoint. And the important thing is for each of those different dimensions, for each of those different scenarios, there will be a different drawn out abiogenesis zone. Ones that are everywhere might seem nice because then they could work everywhere. But those are actually scientifically some of the least interesting because there's no way, at least via that method, to test them.
Right, right. Well, what an exciting time to be an astrobiologist, right?
It's a great time. Yes. Yeah.
We just need to get our engineering friends to invent warp drive so that we can actually find out.
That would be the best way to do it.
But until then, we've got your brilliant work to lean on. And I'm really excited at the possibility of, again, you know, being here at Cambridge. Or if not, we can continue to chat and collaborate. And even if I don't get this job, I think it was a successful visit because we got a podcast out of it.
Yay!
So yay.
And we got to talk about Star Trek, which is great fun.
Yes, exactly. Well, Paul, thank you so much for being on Strange New Worlds. This was truly a pleasure. I'm glad we did it.
Thanks, Mike. This was a lot of fun.
So, you might be wondering whether or not I got the job at Cambridge. I'm sad to report that I didn't. Still, it was an enormous honor to be among the finalists, and it was fun to be able to visit that historic university and share my latest work with really bright minds across the pond. I'm extra delighted that I got to record the interview that you just heard with Dr. Paul Rimmer. So in all, it was a great trip. Not the result I hoped for, of course, but thrilling, productive, and eye-opening nonetheless. In other news, I was recently on NPR's Shortwave podcast with Professor Mohammed Noor, one of the official science consultants for the Star Trek universe, talking about the science behind another big sci-fi phenomenon, Dune. This was actually really funny because I don't know very much about Dune. I've never read the books or watched the movies, but I do have a lot of thoughts about desert worlds. Plus, I love teaming up with Mohammed Noor. So check that out. You'll find the link to that discussion in the show notes. That's all for this episode of Strange New Worlds. Until next time, stay safe, stay curious, and I'll see you out there.